Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
With Professor Jennifer Curtin this morning. Kia ora, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Rachel.
It's been a big week in politics, particularly for the National Party. Let's start there. We've got a new leader, Christopher Luxon, and a new deputy leader, Nicola Willis. Now, I mean, what do we know about this duo already? What's the, I guess, been the media and the political response to it? And what actually is there to learn about these two?
Well, I think there's still quite a lot to learn about Luxon because we haven't seen very much of him, and he's only been a year in Parliament. We know some things about him from the media and also from his maiden speech. So he's socially conservative and hasn't had a chance to vote no on lots of the conscience issues that have come up over the last 3 years, but certainly did vote against banning protest in safe areas outside abortion clinics. Mm. He's now changed his position on that and said that when it comes to the second reading, he will support a ban, won't support the banning of protests. So that's interesting. He obviously has some flexibility around conscience issues, but more generally, he's sort of media are really interested in his religious dimension and how his faith will inform his politics. He said it's a personal thing and that it won't. But Nicola Willis, we know more about. So she's part of the social liberal, if you like, wing of the party. She was part of the group that installed Todd Muller, so she's still got a wee bit of baggage. But she was a natural choice for Luxon to appease or to demonstrate that National could go back to being what we used to call a broad church. It seems a bit weird to be using the term church when you have a evangelical leader of a party, but that's sort of the logic, that you kind of span the different groups within the caucus and try and bring them all together by having leaders or co-leaders of different persuasions.
Now, it's kind of, I guess, been a big discussion that having two new figureheads, is it going to just be that they are figureheads, or are we going to see big changes in the way that the party is running? Because there's been lots of issues with lack of diversity in the party, and obviously, I mean, five leaders in as many years is quite a lot of instability going on there. What do you think we need to see from the National Party for them to prove that they are actually getting themselves back on track, whatever that's going to look like?
Yeah, I think the lack of diversity in this leadership lineup is something they're going to have to address. And, you know, where is Shane Reese and what are they going to give him? So we know that there's going to be a shadow cabinet reshuffle announced on Sunday. So we're assuming, some of us are assuming, that Bridges must have done some kind of deal to back out of the leadership race. So that would suggest he's going to get something like finance. But they're going to have to reward Reti for the work that he did. And, you know, just acknowledging that his knowledge and expertise and really pressing issues around COVID and health more generally is important. But despite having worked with Collins, but, you know, like, that's another way of doing this healing. I think the challenge is going to be still around some things in terms of internal culture within the party, because this is really why Jackie Dean, you know, this is kind of what led to the Collins, you know, political suicide moment. So there's some stuff to work out there, and there's also the relationship with the party machine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Goodfellow is still, you know, he's been there a long time. There's not a sense that other board part of the party is moving with the times in the way that you'd hope this leadership is going to do. And I think that's the real thing. It's both an internal focus and an external focus that these leaders are going to have to demonstrate, which is keep the party together, but also, like, recognise that this can't be John Key all over again. We're in a different time. We're in a different set of, you know, really pressing policy issues, and a whole bunch of new voters that have come into the electorate, you know, that will be participating in politics that weren't there in 2008.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about COVID because we can't avoid it at the moment. Two big, I guess, things happening for us here. Obviously, we're moving into the traffic lights this week. Very exciting, a little bit scary as well. What has been, I guess, the response from the different political parties and from some of the commentary that we've seen about this shift? Because it's always changing. That narrative is, you know, adapting as the situation adapts. What's the kind of, I guess, feeling out there at the moment from your perspective, Jennifer?
Well, I think we are seeing, you know, this sort of kind of a little bit of thrill, a little bit of excitement. You know, hairdressers opened last week and they were sort of jam-packed with people. Mm-hmm. I think there's still concern about how this need to still, at least under red light, to behave, and that will businesses be able to ensure that those who are vaccinated, that everybody who's there inside is vaccinated and so on, without, you know, sort of that sort of being able to do it in a way that's respectful.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's also still some confusion even on the government website. So when I was prepping for this morning and I popped onto the COVID link that I thought yesterday had the traffic light system up, it said, sorry, we're down, you know, cleaning the site up. And I think that's the media drew attention yesterday to some different sites having different aspects around the big gigs that will require sort of masking or not masking. And even for summer school at the university, we're still waiting to have confirmed, you know, whether we all have to wear masks inside, under, even if we're vaccinated and everybody is vaccinated when we're giving lectures from January 4th, for example. So still some confusion, but also some excitement. And I think if we all just look at that, you know, that lovely big PDF with lots of type in it, sort of a poster, I think the critical thing is the left-hand side, if we're thinking about when Auckland might move to orange and when everybody might move to green, is there's some really clear criteria about community transmission and preparedness of the health system and how it can cope.
Mm.
And those are going to be the triggers for government. But on the whole, I think people are kind of ready to put their toe in the water again.
We have seen quite a bit of discussion, particularly from iwi leaders up north, about concern about people travelling from Auckland, particularly to those really hotspot holiday areas, which also have quite low vaccination rates at the moment, particularly for Māori communities. And we've seen a lot of discussion about, I guess, where the government's advice and recommendations is bumping heads with the local community and iwi advice and concern about that. What do you think we're going to see across summer in that space? I mean, we've already seen that Waitangi Day is not going to be happening in the way it's always happens in person. It's going to be moving into an online system this year. What do you think are going to be some of the big things we see over the next few months?
Well, I think that's, you know, the decision to put Waitangi online, go virtual with the commemorations and the celebrations and so on, is a really important signal to government that they have to be cognizant and protect the north and get in behind iwi leaders and that particular regions that are looking to put in place their own, you know, blocks, if you like, to incoming visitors. And those, we know the data is there to demonstrate just how vulnerable Māori communities are. And we've seen a lot on social media and a lot from scientists and Māori scholars about this. So the government has evidence that this is a really important thing to take into account. Kelvin Davis came out yesterday and said he wholly supported the Waitangi decision. And the government's saying they're working with police and with iwi around the Paihia and other regions that want to shut off from tourists. I mean, this is a really important thing that government, if they are truly saying they're working with Māori and Māori health providers and respecting their treaty obligations as partners and as the Crown, then actually they really got to turn down the volume that we'll probably hear from tourist operators and those with batches up there, that actually it's just one summer, you know, and there'll be, once the vaccination rates increase and iwi feel ready, and the Māori health providers feel ready to be able to look after their communities, then that's when we go back.
Well, let's talk about, I guess, the elephant in the room of COVID at the moment, which is Omicron. Still haven't quite worked out how to say that one yet. Just as we're sort of getting ready to open up a little bit, it's reared its head overseas. And there's been some really interesting reactions across the globe politically to how to handle this while we're still waiting to hear from the scientists what they actually know about this variant, particularly its transmissibility and how it's going to affect people who are vaccinated as well. Now, what has been some of the striking things for you about how folks across the world have reacted to this?
Yeah, I think this is a really... I mean, I think the gut reaction for many of us still locked down is just when we're getting back out there, oh my gosh, here's a new variant, should we be worried? And initially, the reaction was we should be super worried. But really, it's the science. You're right, the science hasn't finished doing it. The scientists haven't finished examining this. I mean, the World Health Organization is worried about it, but a lot of this is about the low vaccination rates in South Africa, which are around 24%, only 2% fully vaccinated in Nigeria. So, you know, this is where that, you know, a lot of the developed countries and the wealthy nations just suddenly close their borders to these countries and saying, well, we need to look after our own while they give out their third doses and you know, have a stash of vaccines on the side. Meanwhile, you know, like the African nations, you know, are still struggling to give people a single inoculation. So what we know is that different groups have really been pushing. There's one in Australia called End COVID for All, and they call it COVAX, and it's trying to get governments to donate more money and more of their stash of vaccines to these countries, because apparently at this rate, if the vaccine rollout on the continent of Africa, for example, if it carries on at this rate, they won't be fully vaccinated until 2030. And we can imagine that this variant and others, so the argument is that variants like Omicron, when they find like a reservoir of unvaccinated people, that's when the new variants emerge. So actually, you know, economically, if we want to go for an economic argument as well as a public health one, you know, this is when we should be thinking global public health, not just, you know, nationalistic positions. And we're in a position to do that now if we're, you know, apart from our hard-to-reach communities, you know, we're almost, I don't know, like, what is it, 92 double-vaxxed? We could be, you know, giving more to countries that need it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts this morning, Professor Jennifer Curtin. It's always great to have you on the show. Have a great rest of your Thursday, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Cool. Thank you very much, Rachel.
Ka kite.
You just heard a bit of political commentary
with Professor